All right, good afternoon. I am delighted to moderate our session today, and I hope you've been having a blessed day. I've been so blessed to worship this morning with all of you and the last plenary. I don't know about you. That was extremely
moving. Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah. And remind us of why we do what we do, right?
Yeah.
Put it in context.
Yeah.
So, we have three excellent presentations lined up for you, audience. Glad you can join us. And the first set of speakers comes in a pair. We have Mackenzie Edwards, newly minted graduate from Oral Roberts, and also her faculty mentor, Dominique Pesma, and they will be talking about human flourishing through affordance production by Nietzsche Construction. Very intriguing. Let's welcome them.
Thank you. Yeah, I am blessed to work with some great students at Oral Roberts University. And I'm an engineering professor, been there 30 years, and I am really interested in what the role that engineers have to play in this science and faith conversation. So that's what we look at, and I get help from engineering students. Biomedical engineering is Maisie, and another student, Christian Montgomery, helped us with this presentation too. He couldn't make it. And I've seen over the years that a lot of what we do is a synthesis of, we look at what's going on in other fields, and we try to, as engineers, try to make, what do we make of this? You know, engineers say that kind of thing. What do we make of this? Oh, scientific discoveries. And so you can see from the title that this is drawing from affordances, from the area of ecological psychology, niche construction from biology and evolutionary studies, and human flourishing. So psychology, and you're going to see, I'm going to get into cosmology, and it's pretty cool to see what all is going on that kind of can synthesize together into some pretty neat stuff. So let's dive in. We're going to look at affordance-based reverse engineering, and there's a term right there I should probably define. It's a very simple term. Affordance is an agent has a relationship with an environment that allows a potential action to be taken. That's an affordance. You're sitting in a chair that affords sitability. It's very simple. So we're going to show how this idea relates to this new idea from George Ellis, Templeton Prize winner and renowned cosmologist and physicist. George Ellis has introduced just last year in an article this idea of possibility spaces, and we're going to see how it relates to that. And then look at the relation between affordance production and niche construction, and then finally affordances and possibility spaces enabling human flourishing. So Donald Norman took this idea that was originally proposed by James Gibson in Ecological Psychology in his book, The Design of Everyday Things, and really introduced it to the engineering community. This idea of an affordance is a relationship between the properties of an object and the capabilities of that agent that determine just exactly how the object could possibly be used. That's another way of saying it. And what he said in this book that really struck me was that affordances provide strong clues as to the operation of things. And this is why I think affordances are very important in reverse engineering. And I'm not the only one. Jonathan Meyer at Clemson University has written a book on affordance-based design, where he says the concept of affordance, what a system provides to an end user or to another part of the system, so that could be a part-to-part affordance that ultimately leads to an end user affordance. This is an underlying and unifying principle in the science of product design and also reverse engineering. And this, since engineers create affordances, and since affordances are all over in nature, I'm thinking this is strong evidence that the universe itself is an engineered system. You see my thought process there? So, what about George Ellis? I knew about him, but I saw this article last year and I was really excited because not only he's written books with Stephen Hawking and a prolific author and recognized world leader in cosmology, a Templeton Prize winner, he came up with this new idea in this article entitled The Philosophical Problems in Cosmology, a deep dive into the foundations of cosmology. Now notice he's talking about philosophical problems in cosmology. So there's physical cosmology, and then there's philosophical cosmology, which goes beyond the science into more, I think, more interesting questions. And let's see what he has to say then. This is what he introduces. The curious nature of the cosmos is in its possibility spaces. And this is George Ellis's new terminology. He says, I claim that the deep structure of the universe is timeless, eternal possibility spaces of a Platonic nature. These underlie the nature of what is possible in the physical universe and what is not. These are a way of re-expressing the nature of the laws of physics in terms of a space of possible physical outcomes. In other words, what can be in the universe and what agents can do in the universe. And I'm claiming that this is very closely associated with affordances, both part-to-part affordances and end-user affordances, because affordances are simply those relationships that allow a potential action to be taken, including even mental spaces or mental actions that agents take. And Ellis goes on to talk about biological possibility spaces. Most importantly and remarkably, biological possibility spaces include the possibility of agent consciousness and the symbolic capacity that allows society and technology to flourish. There is also an abstract space of all possible thoughts underlying all the thoughts that intelligent beings actually have. This space is the foundation of our mental capacities, with some of these possibilities being realized in each individual brain via our brain functioning during our lifetime. So what data is relevant in cosmology? According to Ellis, the key methodological question for cosmology is, what kind of data is relevant? Should we only take into account the science? What about everyday life? Should the nature of biological possibility spaces also be considered relevant? My position, and this is George Ellis speaking, is that biological and mental emergent phenomena are key, irreducible aspects of reality, just as much data about the nature of the cosmos as we get from the sciences. They are key aspects of the way things are. Data about everyday life and associated possibilities is data about the universe. Thus, in my view, we should take into account data not only about physics and the physical universe, but also data about life, including our mental and social universes. If we take this viewpoint, the really deep issue in cosmology is this: why do these possibility spaces exist and have the nature they do? And I would say, why do we see the structure of layered dependent affordances? It's the same kind of question. I mean, look at what, this is one of the best parts of the article with Ellis. He says, physicists who take into account only scientific data proclaim that there is no meaning in the universe. But this is a selection effect resulting from their chosen scope of the data. And here he's referring to Steven Weinberg. And he says, it leads to the paradox of thinking that it is meaningful to make statements that the universe is meaningless. Right? It is a simple observational fact that the world is teeming with purpose, biological, economic, political, social, scientific. Why and how does all this purpose exist? At a deep level, it exists because physical, biological, and mental possibility spaces, or affordances, allow it to exist. And here is the thing. Possibilities that are realized include visions of great art and scientific achievement, poverty and wealth, compassion and selfishness, and above all, concepts of love and hate, good and evil. Moral and ethical virtues and evils are part of the mental possibility space, which can be realized here or on any other planet in the universe. They can be thought about because they are included in the mental possibility space and have been there since time began. Humans have demonstrably contemplated purpose and meaning and ethics for millennia, and their existence is data on how things are. The existence of these possibility spaces is part of the deep structure of the cosmos. In that sense, meaning is built into the foundations of existence. So, that is Ellis's view on possibility spaces. And I hope you can see the relationship there with the concept of affordances that engineers have been wrestling with thanks to evolutionary psychologists. Now let's look at this relationship to niche construction in biological evolutionary studies. According to Reitfeldt and Kiverstein, Affordances are possibilities for action that the environment offers a form of life. And an ecological niche is a network of interrelated affordances available in a particular form of life on the basis of the abilities manifested in its practices. Affordances are relations between aspects of a material environment and abilities available in that form of life. And a niche is simply a function or purpose of the species within an ecological community, including the environment to which it has become adapted, as well as its role as producer and consumer of food resources. According to Rob Withagen, the concept of affordance might also help to clarify the process of niche construction, what this process actually consists in at a behavioral level, and is the perception, utilization, destruction, and creation of affordances. In constructing a niche, animals perceive and utilize affordances and do so by by so doing, create and destroy other action potentials. Here you see an unspoken reference to epigenetics, right? Hence, an affordance analysis can not only help in clarifying how the niche is constructed, it also helps to understand what the modification of the niche consists in. Indeed, animals bring about changes in the affordance layout, and this modified layout is then passed on to offspring. Interesting, huh? Let me skip over this. But here is an important idea. Affordances invite. They're not merely action potentials, but they can also invite particular behavior. The strength of this invitation depends on the capabilities of the agent, the importance for survival or thriving, cultural conditioning, and personal history and experience, according to this team of researchers. And agency is the capacity to modulate the coupling strength with the environment. The agent can influence to what extent he or she is influenced by the different invitations that affordances elicit. By modulating the coupling strength, the agent simply alters the dynamics of the animal-environment interactions and thus the behavior that emerges. So we have some role to play as agents within the environment to engage in this niche construction. I'm going to let Maisie take over at this point to just introduce you to the idea of an affordance structure matrix.
So an affordance structure matrix is a matrix that you can use in engineering to basically assess the general purpose and the efficiency of the design and be able to identify design flaws in synthetic systems. So originally this was done by John Meyer, and he created this. And so at the top of all the rows, you can see all the different components of a vacuum cleaner. And then how specific you are with this depends on the model you're using and what layer of engineering you're looking at. So if you're doing electrical work, you can look at design circuits and things like that. So, and then when you go down the rows, you can also see that you've got the AUA and then the AAA.
User affordances.
So the artifact.
End user affordances.
So end user affordances are the things that you would typically think about using a vacuum for. So you want to vacuum up dirt, dust, and all that kind of stuff. And then the bottom two half is the part-to-part affordances. So that's how the different parts or components of an engineered system interact with each other.
Or artifact-to-artifact affordances, part-to-part affordances.
So, and then these affordances also have positive and negative connotations. So you can think about, like, when you're vacuuming, it's sucking up the dirt, that would be positive. And if it's creating a lot of heat, that might be negative. So we're taking these concepts and we're using them and applying them to natural systems. So I did an analysis of a kidney. So this is a kidney affordance structure matrix. And as you can see here, we've got the end user affordances. So these are the pieces that you would see in the human body. So the top three, filter and reabsorption and secretion, are the main ways that your kidney helps you. And then these are some of the ways that the kidney can become injured or start damaging other parts of your body through failure to function properly. And then these are all the part affordances. That's a lot of biochemistry.
So you notice we've moved from an artificial system and looking at the reverse engineering of an artificial system, a vacuum, to a natural system here. And now let's move on to a living whole type of system, which engages in a kind of niche construction, right? You all know about beavers and how they seek a niche. And so here you see kind of up front, what does the beaver have? It has trees, has predators, has a stream, and it also has parts of its own body that it can use to begin to choose actions. It can swim, it can chop down trees, it can drag those trees, it can warn family members by slapping its tail on the pond. And these are why you have certain boxes filled in on the affordance structure matrix, is because certain things, certain elements of the system can work together to accomplish certain to allow certain affordances. But a beaver, it's not a static thing. It's a dynamic creature who can create new affordances, right? These might be the initial affordances, but through niche construction, you see new affordances arising, like a dam, a pond, a lodge. Foliage also comes in to produce these. Actually, these are new elements. I'm sorry, I said these are affordances. These are new elements of the system that can result in new affordances through building, constructing of the niche. So this is a new kind of modification that we've made to the affordance structure matrix to try to help see how these affordances can become layered or nested in space and time.
The nice thing about the affordance structure matrix too is you can grow or reduce the size of the matrix to fill your needs. So obviously with the kidney, we had a very complex model. And with these niches construction, you can see that you can simplify it so that you can get a better idea and look at only the factors that you want to analyze.
So we just got one affordance structure matrix left. And this is where we're going to get to human flourishing. But first, I read a really great doctoral dissertation recently by Marcus Muehling entitled Neurobiology, Evolution and Theology, Evolutionary Niche Construction and the Ecological Brain and Relational Narrative Theology. And he talks about how God is our ultimate niche. And niche construction provides a fruitful key metaphor for understanding the relationship of the triune God to the world. The triune God can be modeled as the ultimate niche constructor, because life and environment are identical to each other in God's relational narrative essence. From the perspective of creation, God can be seen as the ultimate or eschatological environment for his creatures. All creatural niche construction is actually niche reception as a gift from the Creator. I thought that was pretty cool. So here is our attempt at a simple affordance structure matrix for human beings. And you can see the elements of a simple system across the top: God, self, others, Earth, solar system, outer space. These contribute to a knowledge, contribute to allow us to live. We can get into the whole fine-tuning thing there, but it also allows or affords a knowledge of God, right? From Romans 1:20, that's an affordance. We know, we can know God, or we can suppress that knowledge, as it talks about in Romans, right? We can sin. But we can also repent, and we can love. And so these are affordances that are key in pursuing a niche. Now you can see the next one, just like with the beavers, we build things too. We build families, we build churches, we build a livelihood. And this results in new, like I put self plus, not because it takes up a little tiny space, but it's like we become better through the kinds of niche constructions we pursue if we pursue God. And we can help others build up themselves, so you have others plus. And now, Christian Montgomery talked about the importance of forgiveness, and there's been a really interesting Templeton work lately on how humans flourish as due to a lot of the ways that we're able to forgive, and that's an important part of flourishing for humans. But we also can work, we can play, we can learn, we can grow, we can share, we can worship. And eventually, this leads to, life plus plus would be eternal life in our ultimate niche with our Creator. So, similar to the way the beaver engaged in niche construction, humans also can engage in this kind of niche construction. And to finalize here with the final statement, affordances invite us into the possibility spaces, according to George Ellis, where we find our true niche, worship and enjoyment of our Maker. And this niche is received, constructed, and refined as we become empowered by the Holy Spirit to produce new affordances that we can then share or bestow on others, including our own offspring. What do you think?
Thank you for your time.
Yeah.
Question?
Yes, please.
Yeah, two, if that's all right. Sure. First off, have you interacted much with the work of Dennis Walsh at UT Toronto or Andre Arial at UT Missouri?
No, I'm going to write down those names.
Dennis Walsh talks about affordances and niche construction, and he's not operating as a Christian philosopher at all. Andre Arial is actually an atheist. But they're really just trying to drive towards a more teleological view of organisms, which I think is far more favorable.
Actually, now I think I'm familiar with that name, but I'll look it up. He's got books or articles?
So yeah, he's going to give you some articles at the end.
Cool. And the other second name?
Andre Arial. It's with an incident W, though.
Arial?
A-R-I-E-W, yeah.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. And the second question is just kind of off of that, is my current research topic deals a lot with niche construction and, you know, trying to reevaluate how the organism against the view of them is sort of a middle term between the gene and the environment, right? It's actually active and teleological, right?
Yeah.
And looking at that from a theological lens.
What's your name?
Seth Hart, S-E-T-H-H-A-R-T.
He's not far from you.
Yeah, yeah.
Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Well, I just flew out of Tulsa, so I'm in Fayetteville, Arkansas.
Oh.
Yeah, my parents actually live in Garland, so.
I was hoping you would come to this talk. I really need to learn more about niche construction.
Oh, gosh. Well, I was going to ask you about it, so.
Other questions or comments? Yes.
With regard to Ellis, would his view, would he see it as a deterministic, in other words, that the initial state of the universe was such that it provided for all these possibilities. And is that something that he sees as being deterministic in the sense that it would produce those, or it was a potentiality?
I don't think he would be deterministic about it. I do think he would think it was all built in from the beginning, but not in a deterministic sense. Are those two compatible? Those two ideas, built in but not deterministic.
Yeah, I mean, I was wondering whether. Yeah. I guess maybe inevitability.
I really want to interact with George Ellis on this, but he's a Templeton Prize winner, you know, and I should just email him, but I haven't yet. Yeah, Bill.
How do you include students? And this is it strikes me that it's very complicated at times.
Yeah.
And Mackenzie, tell us your story.
So a lot of the stuff that I've done is looking at how you build the affordance structure matrices, the correct ways to do that, and like what parts and pieces and how they interact and how they change over time. So a lot of my focus has been actually on the applications, like how many different ways can we apply affordance structure matrices and what can they teach us about engineered systems? And then also just purely the implication of having an engineered system itself teaching us about better ways to design. So if you saw the kidney one, that came from a project I did earlier where I compared a hemodialysis machine and a live kidney. And you learn a lot about the ways that we can improve our own designs based on the designs of God. So
biomimetics.
Yeah. So in my personal research, I do a lot of like what have we done and what has God done and how can we, in living out, having our Imago Dei, how can we live out our image of Christ through our work as engineers and as designers, and how can we move from our seemingly, you know, rough and very flawed designs, and how can we move them towards the elegance of creation that we see in everyday life? And this includes how can we engineer and design ourselves and work towards forming ourselves through discipline, prayer, reading the Bible? How can we make ourselves more Christ-like by studying His creation and how we are created? So that's kind of how I played a part in this. It was much much more like grunt work, and I'm super interested in using this for medicine as well.
And when you're doing synthesis work like this, there's just so much to read. Because you're drawing from different fields, and there's so much being done in all those fields. So you have the students do the reading. That's right.
There was a one time where I had just gotten finished with a biochemistry class, and literally the next day he hands me a book on the anthropic principle of biochemistry. Mm-hmm. I almost cried. It was like 800 pages. but I really enjoyed it. And then I was also a TA for him for the
history of quantitative thought class.
So I got to do a lot of work with where science has come from and where it's going.
Yeah, just a follow-up on what your approach for comparing engineered systems to natural systems. That natural systems aren't necessarily optimal. So how does that fit in? Because, I mean, evolution works with what it has.
We do, yeah.
So you end up with with what appears to be weird means of achieving an end because of where the system started.
Right. Now, a partial answer to that is reverse engineering projects by nature look at an existing specimen. Now, reverse engineers know that that specimen might not be pristine straight off the factory line. It might have some corruption, some wear and tear, some degradation involved with it. So when we look at natural systems, now this initial question you're all probably thinking of, how much of what we see in nature is from the beginning, or how much might be due to the fall, you know, corruption?
Well, I guess I wouldn't say that suboptimal has had anything to do with the fall. Uh-huh. The way evolution systems work is that they work with
tinkerer, right? Tinkerer,
right? Yeah. And that isn't necessarily a sign of the fall.
But it could be the way. But it certainly could be the way that God has engineered the universe.
The other thing.
So we're open to that.
The other thing to think about too, as we learn more about these systems and natural systems, a lot of our understanding of these systems is flawed itself. So when you look at like biochemical pathways and stuff like that, at first glance, it might look really messy and really dumb and really like, nah, this really doesn't work very well. But as we learn more, we've learned that there's actually a lot of eloquence to these systems. So when you look at even glycolysis, I know there was a young lady who had a project on that. There's actually quite a bit of optimization. And one of the readings that I did was actually on the anthropic principle of biochemistry. And it was showing that there's actually a lot of elegance and a lot of intentionality behind the way that the world works. So my view on it is just that even if I don't understand, it is from my lack of knowledge, not from a lack of design, and I don't know enough about the fall and how that impacts creation to know whether you can say, oh, this is because of the fall. But I would just attribute it to my lack of knowledge, not to the fact that it isn't designed.
But this is an interesting question. Is taking this reverse engineering approach, we're being open-minded about how these systems came about. It could be, you know, through natural selection and evolutionary processes. That's a real possibility. And by doing the reverse engineering analysis, you can gain some insight into which makes the most sense, special creation or evolutionary natural processes.
Thank you for your question, and thank you so much, Dominique.